Hi there, I'm K-Town, and on this edition of Mysterious Radio.
Well, I'm a psychiatrist. I work primarily with children and young adults in Los Angeles. I have a private practice. I've been doing this for 10, 12 years. I've also been really involved in psychoanalysis until probably 3-4 years ago, because I saw it as a very in-depth, although long-term and chronic, but in-depth way to really change one's personality and character based on developmental needs that were not addressed early in childhood. And I was very passionate about that for a long time. About 3 years ago, almost to the day, in March, early April of 2020, I and many others, everyone really that got access to the world and information, were told suddenly that we had to drop everything in our lives. And that included psychoanalysis, that included Boy Scouts, church, going to school, working, and to just stay home. And if we went out, we had to wear masks, and we couldn't get close to other people emotionally or physically. We were not allowed to make our own decisions. We were ordered to really give up just about all of the fundamental freedoms that we have as Americans. And it didn't smell right to me. Something felt wrong about it. And within about 10 to 12 days, I was certain that this was wrong. And I couldn't sit by and do my work on an individual level with my patients and not say something. Because I feel like for me, as a psychiatrist and as an individual, as a social person, being honest and being truthful is the most important starting point for any relationship with others, and also a relationship with yourself. I work with a lot of addicts, and one of the foundational qualities of all addicts is dishonesty. They lie. You cannot be an active addict and be an honest person. You can be a recovering addict and be an honest person, because most addicts, if they're honest, know that they are at risk of falling prey to another rebound use of their substance of choice at any time. And that honesty is really one of the qualities that keep them abstinent. It's the ones that say, I've got this. I don't need to worry about it anymore, and wind up going back into rehab. So I felt that the United States as a whole needed to hear the truth. And I couldn't do that in my office one-on-one because it wasn't a large enough, loud enough, broad enough voice. So I began to speak. For the first time in my career, I went to speak publicly. I was invited to a school board meeting in Orange County in May. This is after I wrote an op-ed article with a colleague of mine here in Los Angeles, directed at the then mayor, Eric Garcetti, who had issued what was called a stay-at-home or safer-at-home order for all Los Angelinos. Stay at home, you're safer at home. And I didn't feel that that was right. I didn't feel that staying at home was the safe thing to do. And I wrote about it in the local paper, the LA Daily News, which published the article. And from that, I received actually a lot of interest. Physicians who were traveling, school officials, school board members saw this, and they began to invite me to talk about my views, because at the time they were in the minority. And I went down to Orange County and I spoke in front of the school board meeting, packed, hundreds of people, about 700 were online and Zoom as well, on the subject of returning children to school, reopening schools. And I said at the meeting, we have a problem here. This was 2 or 3 weeks into school closures, maybe a month at the most. And parents wanted their kids back. A lot of them did. And many of them didn't. Many of them wanted them to stay at home for months. And the issue was, do we reopen the schools now, or do we wait until the fall? Well, of course, they ended up waiting for over a year and a half. The answer was far worse than anyone had expected. But my argument was, we shouldn't have closed them to begin with. We made a mistake. We, the adults, let children down. We let our anxiety, our fear, dictate our actions toward children. And we were using our children as a way to palliate that anxiety and that fear. Instead of treating ourselves by stepping up as adults, swallowing our fear and acting in spite of it, we were sacrificing our children on the altar of emotional safety. That was the argument I made in May of 2020. And that was the beginning, the foundation of really all my other arguments that followed, because this just kept going, as everyone knows. Schools didn't reopen, businesses didn't reopen, masks became ubiquitous and required. People were being arrested. Here in Los Angeles, famously, a lone paddleboarder was actually arrested in Santa Monica in the water by police because he violated the don't go in the water policy. He had the hot sand, wet sand rule. You could only go on the hot sand, not on the wet sand. It was absurd. And I was concerned that if we didn't stop this soon, we didn't arrest this burgeoning craziness, that we were going to fall into a really dark hole. And that's exactly what happened. And that's what led to the next 2 to 3 years of my speaking and writing, and ultimately my first book, which came out in the late November, December area of 2021, which was the United States this year, How America Fell Victim to a Mass Delusional Psychosis. And that was the ultimate endpoint of all of my thinking, writing, and speaking, starting in April/May of 2020.
Yeah, you bring up some really good points. It was just, it was craziness. I've never seen anything like it. And I do remember a point where I was going through Walmart trying to shop for food and nothing on the shelves. You know, it was crazy. Let me ask you something. Okay. So, I know what I witnessed here, in my part of the world, as far as school closings, there was, you know, a good deal of people coming forward saying they were against the schools closing. But also there was a ton of people for everything to close. That's businesses, right? And everything, I thought was just it's mind boggling. I was like, how are they going to stay afloat? I mean, how are they going to continue to open their doors after all this mess is cleared up? But were you seeing the same thing out there? Were people calling for businesses to shut down as well?
Very much so. I was in Los Angeles, which was really the heart of darkness. You know, New York, San Francisco, Portland, LA, a lot of these coastal urban cities. And there's some exceptions as well in the interior of the country, but to a large extent, it was the coastal urban cities that were really pushing this. And that started to raise questions in my mind. Why is this happening in varying degrees in different parts of the country? This should be a problem that affects everyone, and we should all have the same response to it. It's not a political issue, right? It's a medical one. It's not racial or economic. At least it shouldn't be. This should be something like dirty water that affects everybody. And so I started to ask myself these questions. Well, why is this so different in certain areas? And why here in Los Angeles, which you have wonderful weather, healthy people, we are not jammed up in towers for the most part. Why are people so supportive, a large percentage of the LA population, so supportive of what is clearly an emotional reaction to a very specific and scientific medical problem? And that opened up a whole can of worms, because it started to really challenge the foundations of what I had believed about people and about government and about institutions. One of those beliefs, which I no longer hold, is that people in general are driven to do good and to do the right thing. I don't believe that anymore. I was profoundly disappointed with the general response by people here in my city and even in my community. I was told to attend a safety meeting, for example, on my block by a neighbor who I had previously enjoyed the company of, who's a social worker, and meet with a police officer. This was about 6 months into the whole craziness, but probably end of 2020, because there was a lot of crime on the street. A lot of people were having their houses broken into. And she held a outdoor gathering for the neighbors on the block and had a local police officer come to speak to us. And in the message, in the email, inviting us to go to this meeting, she told us that everyone must bring their own lawn chair. They must park it on the driveway. Each chair must be 6 feet away from the other, and we all have to wear masks. I just sat there staring at that message thinking, this woman has gone mad. She's out of her mind. And this was not uncommon. I would jog around the neighborhood because the gym was closed, and a young woman in her early 20s, I remember passing me by, walking in the gutter, not on the sidewalk, with headphones on, in the opposite direction of how I was running. She jumped away from me into the oncoming traffic when I passed her, because I wasn't more than 6 feet from her body as I passed by her outside in open air. And when I went around the block a second time, she happened to be on the corner about to cross the street. And as I passed her, she crossed in front of me, and then she saw me, and she began screaming hysterically, "Stop following me! Stop putting me in danger!" This is an early girl, you know, 24, 25 years old. And I thought, I've never seen this before outside of a psychiatric institution, which, of course, I have been in. I've worked in one before, not recently. And I felt that every time I left my home, I was entering into an open-air asylum. And so my conclusion was that, actually, I'm living amongst crazy people. I'm living amongst people who don't know what's in their own best interest. And as you pointed out, why wouldn't people want to do what's right, what makes sense for them? Well, they didn't. None of them did. So it started to raise questions for me about who I could trust, and not just people around me, but also institutions. Initially, I was just upset with the government and the bureaucrats and the people that I thought were trying to get power and money out of an opportunity, turning what's a tragedy into an opportunity for themselves. But over time, I realized that it really isn't a problem just of our government and our institutions. It's a problem of our people, because our institutions represent us. And if we have corrupt institutions, not one person, not just one Anthony Fauci or one Barbara Farrar, who's the fake doctor, public health director in Los Angeles that nobody knew about until she started locking down our schools and ordering us to stay away from gyms and wearing masks. It's not just those individuals that I lost faith and confidence in. It's the people that supported them, the voters, the people in the community, the people who could have stood up and said, you know what, we're not doing this. We're done. We need our business, we need our school, we need our health. Anybody that wants to stay home, that wants to Zoom into work, look, we don't support that, but that's your right. It's like religion. Everybody has a right to his own religion. You don't have to go to church. You don't have the right to take people from their church. And that didn't happen. The institutions and the people began to work together against those who wanted to just live their lives like me. And so I have, over time, come to the conclusion that We're in a big crisis in our country right now, and it's not a crisis of medical debate. It's not a crisis of supplies and shots and masks and what to do in certain protocols of disease. The real problem is more fundamental. It's a problem of having a set of institutions and a population of people who simply cannot and will not live in reality. And that's very dangerous. It's like having a psychotic patient who doesn't see or hear things that other people see and hear. When you have a society and a country that is in that position, then you don't have a strong country. And you're also, as a nation, very weak and susceptible to enemies that do live in reality and are taking advantage of that kind of psychotic delusional process that you've fallen into. And my position today hasn't changed. I think it's actually gotten a lot worse.
You know what? Let me jump in here 1 second, because it felt like I was living in some type of crazy psychotic groupthink dream, and no one had the ability to think logically. No one questioned any. It boggles my mind how, you know, you have people that are very intelligent. I think they're very intelligent, have great jobs, but they question nothing coming from the top down. It's just they believe everything.
That's an excellent point. Intelligence had nothing to do with it.
Right, right.
I've always been very supportive and admiring, and I'm admitting this, it was a naivete, of intelligence. But I no longer believe that intelligence is a valuable tool in the absence of common sense. And most of my colleagues are very intelligent. You have to be smart to get into medical school. But most, I'd say 80% of my colleagues fell for this, and I don't even associate with them anymore. Intelligence is not protective. Think about this like an immune system to insanity. Intelligence is not protective of an infection of insanity. You need something else. And this has led to a whole other discussion, which I'm still trying to answer, conclusively, which is, if it's not intelligence, it's not education, if all those people went equally mad, then what are the qualities that we need to restore the individuals in our country to create a stronger immune system to this insanity in the future? And that is a very important and very challenging question.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I did an interview with a Harvard doctor, and off the record, I just asked him, have you ever seen anything like this? And he's, I can't tell you how. I mean, he was like, it's just some of my colleagues are just, they're not thinking. Logic and common sense is just gone. Yeah. I just don't know what to say about
That's
it.
Right.
But okay, let me ask you this. Now, It's horrible. Now you're seeing the culmination of insisting that businesses close their doors. And now you're seeing the consequences of it. I mean, every time we look up, a business that's been open, one place been open like 100 years closed. I mean, is it, just places that have been there for years and years and years have closed their doors because they have never been able to come out of the devastation from the shutdown. Are you seeing that on your side of the world as well?
We've lost, I would say, between 50 to 60% of the independently owned businesses in Los Angeles since mid-2020. I have virtually no restaurants that I used to go to that I can still go to. I think there's only one that's still running. Everything else is shut down permanently. Little stores and shops gone. Even programs like clubs, and small schools and daycare centers, all gone, all shut down. And in their place, we have vacant lots or we have commercialized, non-independent, national chains that have stepped in to fill the void. I believe that this is a direct consequence of government institutions, corporations, media supporting it, as well as bureaucrats who work in political institutions coming together and intentionally strangling the middle group of Americans, meaning those who...
You mean the middle class?
...have a root. Not just middle class economically, but more than that, it's there's a sort of middle America. In other words, not the people that work at Kinko's and not the people who work in large office buildings that may not be making a lot of money, but they've got sort of corporate jobs. I mean, the kind of the people that are really the roots of the country, the drivers of productivity, of community bonds, of independent values, like shop owners, like immigrants who have had a store in their family for generations. And they may not even be middle class yet. They might be.
You mean like small business owners? There's something more than
just, yeah, small business owners is probably the largest obvious group because they've been hit the hardest. And they've been decimated in Los Angeles, and I know they've been decimated in the rest of the country because I read the economic report. And I think the reason for it, I think it is intentional, and I think the reason is the independent businesses are the ones that are the least likely to agree to the disruption of their choices, their freedoms, and to give away their independence, whether it's in how they order their products, what they pay their workers, how they set up their parking systems, what types of eco-friendly machines they use in their stores. Corporations love this stuff. They're delighted to have all these intrusions because they can afford to pay for it and to cover the added cost. The small businesses can't. And it's hard to shut down a small business when the owners really want to succeed and they want to continue. They're willing to do it even if they make very little money because they value that independence so much. Well, that independence is what is at risk.
Yeah, I didn't think about it. You make a great point because they were the only ones that bucked anything, the small business owners.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's my point. And that's why they were under the target zone of the national and local government from the very beginning. Eric Garcetti, the mayor of LA that I mentioned earlier that issued the Safer at Home order, soon after that, he actually started to go after businesses in LA directly who wanted to stay open that were not the chain stores like the CVS, the Walmart, the Ralph, but the independent grocery store, the independent hardware store, the shop that sells candles on the corner. They were not exempt from the necessary and useful store allowance that allowed those shops to stay open. Bars and strip clubs and marijuana pot shops were all, they all stayed open too, by the way. And he opened up a program. He began it called the Ambassador Program. And he designated volunteer ambassadors to call in. It was a snitch program, basically. He called it the Snitches Get Riches Program. And you could snitch on a business in your neighborhood that was still open, that was supposed to be closed. And then Eric Garcetti would send the LA Department of Water and Power crews out to issue citations and let them know that if they didn't shut down in 24 hours, that the power would be cut from their building. And he did it. He did it to many businesses. And once that happened, all the small business owners, they had to fold up shop because they couldn't physically keep their businesses open. And this was only the small businesses. I don't remember a single cheesecake factory having this problem. I remember a single Walmart or a 24-hour fitness. None of these other businesses had this issue. They played the game. They stayed open or they just did their time until they could reopen. The small businesses didn't have either of those options. So they were just strangled to death. And it was done at the hands of government.
Absolutely awful. And there was a big deal here in Knoxville where I think it was the health director of the city. She wanted all these bars and things to close down. And then they said that if they opened up, they were going to be arrested. And the mayor said, no, that's not going to happen. Sheriff said, no, that's not going to happen. So there was a big, you know, there was conflict within our local government here. I don't know if you saw it there, but it just I don't know. I've never seen anything like it. One thing I can tell you that I have read in Yahoo, and then we're going to start talking about your book here, how people can possibly see light at the end of the tunnel, if there is any, that there were a slew of big chain stores actually closing that really shocked me, and that it would be happening over the next several years. Are you seeing people there in distress, which is what your second book talks about, how to possibly come out of some of this? But there's been like record number, I think, of reports of, you know, kids having anxiety and committing suicide, and among not just children, but adults as well. And we see it here a lot, but are you seeing it over there? I imagine that you are as well.
It's a disaster. I call it a national trauma. I write about it frequently. When you're kept scared for 2-3 years, it's not possible to just be unafraid again. It's like going through a war and then being told there's been an armistice, a truce, everybody go back to normal. You're going to be watching your back. You're going to be ducking behind trees to avoid sniper fire. You're going to be stepping around objects on the ground covered by brush, thinking it might be an IED. That's completely normal and somewhat rational behavior after going through a war. Well, that's what people are still doing here in Los Angeles. Now, some of it is irrational in the sense that they never should have been afraid to begin with. That's why it's not a perfect analogy, because in a war, you really can die. No one that was young and healthy was really at any statistically meaningful risk of getting seriously ill or dying from the Chinese virus that came out. Nobody. Even now, 3 years later, as Dr. Marty Makary of Johns Hopkins famously said a year ago, after studying every single case of so-called COVID death in children, he went through every single autopsy, every single medical file. There were several thousand. He didn't find a single file that included a healthy child, not one in the entire United States. So everything that we were told, all of the fear-driven orders and compliance mandates, everything was a lie from the very beginning, 100% lie. And from that lie, we developed fear. And from the fear, we developed an addiction to that fear. And from that, we developed a trauma. So my diagnosis of my local community right now is that it has been traumatized. I still see it in people at the gym where I went last week. A woman comes in wearing a full tracksuit with a hoodie, gloves, a bath towel, and a bottle of sanitizing spray, and a mask on her face. And she walks around with these soulless eyes, with wrinkled face, and she's not that old, completely quiet, doesn't speak to anybody, sits at the machine and just sort of stares into space after, of course, sanitizing and wiping it down, barely even moves the arm bars, gets up and does the same thing on another machine, and does this for about an hour. I see this all around the city. I see it not just in my practice with kids who are wetting the bed, who are having tantrums, who are afraid to go to sleepovers, who have become autistic. They can't look at people's faces. They're anxious and tense all the time. They're not eating well. It's also happening outside in the so-called normal community of adults. Everyone in Los Angeles is sick, emotionally and mentally sick. The atmosphere has been poisoned. And I believe it's because of the trauma of having been forced to live in fear for 3 years. I also believe that there's something else happening now, which is exciting and also terrifying. Professor Jeffrey Tucker, who's the head of the Brownstone Institute, and a fantastic writer who publishes articles regularly on Brownstone, on Town Hall, on Epoch Times online, along with Victor Davis Hanson and others. He writes clearly and he writes cogently to the entire United States. It's not a politically driven article. It's just very factual, very straightforward, simple, truthful. He said something very important in our last interview with him on Informed Dissent. He said, people now are suffering the trauma of discovering the truth. The truth always comes out, and it's now coming out, not just in little drips and drops. It's coming out in gallons, in high velocity, high density spray of water, like a fire hydrant. We're getting dumps of truth every single day. Truth about math from the Cochrane Report a couple weeks ago. That was a meta-analysis. Nobody reads meta-analyses, right? Except doctors. Well, they did this time. They had millions of retweets, and it showed after combining together something like 78, I believe, or 87 different studies of over 600,000 people in the United States, they concluded, the meta-analysis of Cochrane concluded that masking had zero benefit, zero. I mean, I knew that from the beginning, but a lot of Americans kind of poo-pooed that away and said, well, it has to have some benefit. No, none, zero. Not just one report, not just one study, every study they combined together, summarized them. That was a bombshell. We're now seeing, as you pointed out earlier, the proven effects, the proven consequences of school shutdowns and lockdowns, 2 years of educational losses, suicide skyrocketing, fentanyl overdoses. I lost two patients in the first time in my career, in my private practice. Two young people died of fentanyl overdoses while being kept at home in the Safer at Home program under Eric Garcetti in 2020, 2021. That never happened to me before. Two of them in Santa Monica died on me. Only two in the last 12 years since I started my practice. And they both died because they were, quote, safer at home. And now everyone is clear, although a lot of people still don't want to mention it and bring it up, that there's no argument now that children were ever at risk and should have ever been kept home. We should never close the school. No one's pushing that really anymore. Some people in very far-flung circles are, but most people, even sort of previous supporters of all these lockdowns, most of them now say, you know what, that was really wrong. That was a mistake. The people who push the policies, of course, are not saying that because they don't want to get in trouble. So I think there's been a recent acknowledgement on some level by many Americans, not all, but many, that we were lied to because the truth is now coming out. And I think that's actually making the trauma in some ways a lot worse because now people are being forced to make a choice. They're being forced to make a choice between acknowledging that they were lied to, that they were robbed of their money, they're robbed of their freedom, robbed of their health, dignity, perhaps being with a loved one at that person's end stage of life, being robbed of those final moments together in the hospital because it was too unsafe to be with grandma or grandpa or mom or daddy. I mean, that's just terrific. And so they're forced to contend with that. And they, of course, they were compliant all along. We had to do it because it was important. The government told us to. Now they're being forced to accept that they were lied to. It was wrong and they should have fought back. That's a really tough pill to swallow. And so a lot of people are seeing the truth, but they're not yet ready to grieve what happened, to accept that they were taken for a ride. And I think that's actually making the stress worse. It's making people even more polarized, making some people even more crazy, more angry, more vindictive, resentful. It's pushing people into opposing corners. I don't think in the long run this is a bad thing. I think it's a necessary process of grieving a loss and moving towards truth and sanity. But in the short run, it's really ripping apart the community. In LA, we have polarized camps now. People who are properly pointing out that we've wrecked our lives for absolutely no reason. Absolutely none. It was all self-inflicted wounds. And then another group of people that are basically seceding from normal society and saying, we're going to live like this forever. We're going to live behind masks and closed doors and zooming things in, because I believe the thought of them acknowledging that that was all wrong, that they should never have done it, they just can't handle it. It would crush them. It would cause them to just collapse. So they're not willing to do it, and they're still living in the lie. I think that's the stage that we're in now.
Yeah, you know what? That is perfect. Yes, you said it perfectly, because even if those decisions put them on their deathbed because they chose to take a vaccine, I'm not saying vaccine's bad or whatever, to each his own, but even if a vaccine was the cause of their demise, I don't think even then they could deal with it. Let me tell you something. Parents, one thing I have seen, and I just wanted to ask you about maybe the generational effects on children, because, you know, their parents now have been put through this, trauma, as you put it. And it's like nothing that none of us have ever experienced. They're passing on this fear to their children, and the children are scared to death that they will continue to carry this fear in their adult life, and maybe even pass on this fear to their kids. I mean, do you see that happening?
Unfortunately, I think the younger generation may be completely lost to us. I am really concerned about that.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that we were trending before 2020, and I say this as a clinician. You know, I see children, I see where they're going, what their problems are, social problems, addiction to cell phones, sort of autistic behaviors, unable to engage in conversation, narcissism, me. It's all about how I look, how I'm perceived. Screw you. Those were poisonous seeds that were planted in society years and years ago, and they've been sort of blossoming since I began my practice about 10 years ago. But they hadn't really overtaken the youth generation yet. I just saw little problems here and there. Some of them were pathologic and needed to be treated. But overall, the kids were still relatively okay. About 3 years ago, after the stay-at-home orders started and every child was locked behind screens and closed doors, their clubs were eliminated, and cell phones were very popular, but they weren't ubiquitous. Now every child has a smartphone. Every child has an Instagram account, and God forbid, even TikTok, unfortunately. And so now 3 years later, what I'm seeing in my practice is that these kids that were having a little slight problems socially, academically, now they're almost non-functional. They are so disconnected from reality because they live behind a screen, and they're so narcissistically driven. They're so focused on their own feelings, and they're being told now, as we all know, one of the big truths that came out in the last couple of years is the truth of ideological indoctrination in the government school system. Insane child abusing teachers who are teaching children lies and telling them that their feelings are more important than reality. And if you feel something, it becomes real. And so now children are walking around unable to manage their feelings and their emotions, and they're attacking others for having feelings thrust at them. You made me angry. You're a bad person. You hurt my feelings. You're bad. My truth is more important than your truth, whatever the hell that means. So my concern is that if these young people are not reacclimated to reality soon, before they become full-fledged adults, and some of them are already in college now, they're already becoming quasi-adults. If they don't get reacclimated to what's real rather than the fantasies of the last 3 years and the lies, they're going to graduate into adulthood and move into institutions that really matter, like law, judgeship, school administration, teaching, they've already done that, becoming parents, managing institutions that house public safety, police, transportation systems like the FAA. They're going to start running for public office. We're going to have a generation, a whole generation of young people, and they're soon to be in their early 20s, late 20s, that are not just patients in the practice. They're not just problems for parents and teachers to manage. They are actually dictating our lives. They are deciding how we live and under what government and legal system we live under. That scares me because they're not normal. They're not healthy. It would be like literally having all the patients in the hospital be turned over to administration and allowed to run the hospital in the psychiatric hospital. That's essentially what we're trying to do right now. We're allowing this to happen. And I don't think that adults, parents, because they were so weak in the beginning, allowing their kids to be locked down, I don't think the parents have the wherewithal to push back right now. I think parents are so scared of their children. They're so extorted by the tantrums. Give them an iPad. Give them a latte. Let him stay up as long as he wants. I'm just too tired to deal with it. That's their attitude right now. That the kids are developing a completely, not just unrealistic, but not survivable way of seeing the world. And if we have a society that is run by people like that, by essentially crazy sick people, then we're not going to have a survivable society. That's my concern about the next 5 to 10 years. I've been writing about this in my Substack frequently, Dissident MD, that it's true we can't fix our main institutions. You can't clean out the top. We can't fix the federal government easily. I get that. But if we don't go after the young, if we don't fix our educational system, our school system, the way we parent, if we don't stop that, then it doesn't matter what else we do on the other end, because the next generation is going to wreck everything anyway.
Okay, so you mentioned this several times. You said, you know, the parents allowed their children to be locked down, but, you know, you get those that say, you know, I'm just doing what they suggested, or I'm doing what the governor said to do, or the law that they put in place, or whatever. I mean, I'm just following the lockdown laws. I mean, so what do you say for those that really didn't want to have their children locked down? What could they do in that instance, or what would you have rather seen the public do in that case?
Take him out of school. I didn't say that at the beginning because it's a pretty extreme position to take, at least I thought it was. But now, today, looking back on it and even looking forward, that's my answer to parents when they say, but I just was doing what I was told. I didn't want to do it, or I didn't want to get in trouble, or it was her last year of school and she wants to go to Harvard, or we don't have a lot of money, or I'm a single parent. There's always a reason. Always, always, always a reason. Whether you're rich, poor, married, single, doesn't matter. I always got a reason. I would call it a rationalization for why the parents, those that, and there was most of them here in LA, not all, some of them did take their kids out, but why those parents kept going along with the program, even though intellectually and emotionally they knew that it was unhealthy. Especially after a few weeks, you know, it was going on now for 2 years. It's not like you could have said, well, they just pulled the rug out from under me. No, you had 2 years of this. You knew it. And so I would say to them, and I say to them now still, you got to pull your kids out of government school. And they'll say, well, I can't because X, Y, and Z. And my answer to that is that you're the parent. You're the adult. You chose to have these children. Your primary obligation is to protect your child and keep your child safe. And if you fail at that, then you failed as a parent. Nothing else matters. So no excuses.
Yeah, but what's taking them out of school going to do exactly?
Well, it's going to do a few things. It's going to put them, it's going to take them out of a sick institution. The government school system is not an educational system. It's simply an indoctrination system. It doesn't teach. It indoctrinates. It's unhealthy. It's sick. You need to remove them from that environment first. And I'm saying this broadly speaking. Obviously, there's a few schools left in the country that are great, that are locally run. I understand that. I'm just speaking broadly. This is the way the system is run right now, especially in districts that have powerful teachers unions like Los Angeles. The teachers union is probably one of the most evil institutions in our country. It is truly a group of primarily women, actually, as most teachers are, that is abusing and destroying the children. Something that I've said a lot recently is that a disproportionate amount of the destruction of our society recently has come from women. And this is very disturbing to me. All of the genital mutilation and chemical castration of children is happening under the scalpel and the tutorship of women doctors, women therapists. There's something very amiss in our country. The maternal instinct of women has been subverted. But
You mean here in the United States?
Here in the United States, correct. Mostly, worse here than anywhere else in the world, actually. I travel quite a bit, and I don't see that happening elsewhere to the degree it's happening here. And I think part of it has to do with the vacuum of masculinity in the country. I think that we have attacked men and masculinity so much that men have seceded, they've receded, surrendered their position of manhood in their home, in their community, as fathers, as parents, as friends. And I think that that vacuum has created really just a sucking effect that's forced women to sort of jump in and take over a lot of the relational roles that men used to play. And I think a lot of women don't want to do that, understandably, not long term. And so I think that they have become now so induced to act on an emotional level, and their emotions have been hijacked. They've been scared, essentially, into doing things that are not good, not in the best interest of their kids, because I think the men have abandoned them. That's my theory on to a large degree why it's happened. But I think that the reason why parents should take their kids out of school, in addition to pulling them out of the sick environment, is that you need to put them in a healthy one. And there is a community and environment growing around the United States. The number of homeschooled kids, for example, has doubled. It did double over about 18 months between 2020 and 2021. That's a huge increase, 100% increase in 1 year. That environment, that community of people who pulled their kids out of school, whether it's at home, whether it's pods, whether it's single mothers getting together and rotating assignments, you can be very creative with this. It puts kids into a different environment that encourages independent thought, creativity, socialization. One thing that a lot of people don't understand about homeschool is that kids who are homeschooled have better social skills than those that go to school. Kids that go to school, government school, they're primarily driven by what they wear, their phones, their popularity, being able to avoid violence if it's a dangerous school, bullying. It's not a very healthy social structure right now. Kids that are out of school, they actually spend less time doing academics, because you can do the whole school thing in a couple hours at a homeschooling program. And then the rest of the day, they actually go in groups of other kids that are supervised by adults, by parents who care about them, not by teachers who don't. And they go to museums. They go to sporting events. They do artwork. They do book club readings. They are inculcated into adulthood, into normal reciprocity, give and take, succeeding and failing, being polite, being modest, being showing generosity and gratitude. Those are the values that they need to learn as children that they're not getting in school. And so the kids that are homeschooled actually learn more about life and reality and maturity, and less about blaming others, being a victim, narcissism, focusing on phones. It's an amazing dichotomy between the government school children and the homeschooled kids. And it doesn't just come from the values of the parents. It's not just white, married, traditional, middle class, middle America Christians, for example, which were the beginning of the homeschooling movement. But it's expanded way beyond that. I've got parents, single immigrant parents, who are putting their kids in homeschools in L.A., and they're doing great. So this is not the anti-homeschooling movement. The teachers union wants you to think that this is some racist cabal to upset society. They say that because it's a threat to their power. Actually, homeschooling is empowering for parents and kids, and it will help to regenerate a true America of healthy young people, which is such a danger to the government that wants to, as Mao did in the 50s in China, take over the lives of kids. Those who are totalitarians, I call them the left, but it's really sort of a totalitarian movement. It happened in China, it happened in the Soviet Union, it happened in North Korea, all over the world in the 20th century. The movement always accomplishes its goal in about two or three steps. One is it creates a crisis, which in this case was the medical emergency of 2020. It offers a solution, which is always to give away your liberties. As we just talked about, all of our liberties were taken away from us. Ostensibly to protect us, but it didn't protect us from anything. And then the third is they go after your kids. And they do that by taking away parent rights about that, because you're not allowed to as a parent. Only the schools can do that. And they start indoctrinating the kids and separating the bond between the parent and the child, so that they can create a whole generation of warriors, just like Mao did in China, that is loyal to the government rather than to the parents. The child will inform on the parent in order to get a better grade in school. I saw this in Santa Monica. One of the kids and parents came to talk to me once about what was going on in the classroom. And the mother was appalled. She told me that the child had been rewarded in class for outing the parent's violation of the stay-at-home order. And the teacher was giving prizes to kids who were actually informing on their parents to the school district. This is communism. This happened in Santa Monica.
That is communism.
It's scary. So this is a big, big, big issue. It's not just about homeschooling. I'm using that as an example because I think it encapsulates most of what my argument is, which is you've got to get your kids back. You've got to take your kids back from the government and institutions and put them back where they belong, which is the home and the community, and form bonds that way. I think that's the way out.
I'll tell you another thing that reminds me of communism. I just had an interview with a lady. Her name was Florence DeSanji, who talks about the MH370 disappearance. Well, she's based in Hong Kong right now, but she says a lot of people over there they're self censoring, you know, themselves.
Yes.
They're doing
That's
it
right,
here, too.
Especially in Hong Kong.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hong Kong was taken over by the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, a few years ago. Journalists have been taken out. They've been sent to black sites on mainland China with hoods over their heads. There's no paper left, no independent press in Hong Kong. The last press was shut down last year, and the owner was arrested. This is exactly what's happened in Hong Kong. I know Hong Kong very well. I have very close friends who have lived there all their lives and have flown back and forth in the last few years. I read about it daily. And Hong Kong is an excellent analogy to where we're heading in the U.S. If you want to know what the end point is of this incursion, this takeover of our country and our children, just look at Hong Kong. The Chinese have had their eye on that for decades, the mainland Chinese, the communists, because they know that it's such a motherload of power and resources and vibrant finance. And it's also a big threat to their dominance, to their totalitarianism. So they took it over slowly but surely, and now it's nothing. It's no different than mainland China. That's what we're headed towards here in the U.S. if we don't stop it. And we've got to, as a country, we've got to rise up above these instigated, and I call them instigated, fights and political differences. You know, the people in power, they want us to think that this is a racist country, or that Americans hate gays and lesbians, or that the rich are preying off of the poor. Well, that's certainly true to some extent with corporatism, but wealthy individual Americans are not preying off of poor people, the business owners, for example. These are all sideshows because they're distracting us from what's really happening, which is all good Americans who are not full-on leftists and anarchists, they all have a lot more in common with each other than any of the people on the top tell us. In other words, the difference in our country, the gap between, let's say, Republicans and just middle-of-the-road Democrats is so much smaller than it is between the left and everyone else in the country. Everyone. There's a small percentage of people in this country that are full-on totalitarians and anarchists. They want no structure, and they want the government to take over everything. It's a small percentage. And those people are truly evil and destructive. Everyone else in the country is just confused. they're all fighting amongst themselves, thinking that their enemy is the guy across the street. And he's really not. He's become your enemy because if we didn't have any local enemies, we'd all turn our attention upward and we'd see that we're all being screwed by the same small group of politicians, bureaucrats, corporations, and media that are all trying to take over our lives. If we can reach that understanding, if we can make that realization, then I think we could actually start to repair our country. But it has to come from the ground up. I don't believe that we can fix it by starting at the top. We have to do it at a community individual level. And if we can do that, then we can return to fixing the small problems in our country, which is what we've always been trying to do. We've always been trying to make our country better incrementally, rather than pretending that we can perfect some sort of utopia by just destroying, taking the legs out of our country, because we've already seen where that's headed. Our country is in a far worse position now, both emotionally on an individual level and also as a nation, than it's been in the last 15 to 20 years, perhaps in the last 50. We are on the brink of a complete collapse on every level. Nothing is working anymore. And it's all due to people agreeing voluntarily to go along with a terrible, terrible program, thinking that the government is their friend and their neighbor is their enemy, when it's actually the reverse.
Exactly. And I know we're over time here. I wanted to just say real quick, because I find it very interesting how you got all these people who went along with the shutdown and everything. And at first, they were for the vaccine. And now, you know, they started opening up all these sites. Everybody was flooding in to get their shot. But those sites started dwindling more. You know, it was less and less people there. And they could see that it was starting to trail off. So they weren't getting so many people to take the vaccine. Something happened in that period of time. Like the masses seemed to now be very wary of the vaccine. And I'm not saying anything bad with it, but now people are very, very adamant about not taking it. And they are the same people who wanted and called for the shutdowns for every place in the United States. So I'm not seeing, you know, I don't know what happened there. Or what's the contrast, or why do you think that happened? Now they trust the government in one sense, and then they don't trust them in another sense.
Well, I think this is the result of what I called earlier the truth dump. It's really hard to hide this massive bag of evidence forever. And that bag of evidence is that these mRNA injections, I don't call them vaccines because they're not really medically vaccines. They never offered any meaningful protection to just about everyone who took them. And they caused significant harm to many and actually killed more people than they could ever have potentially saved the lives of. And that evidence has come out not just from one or two people. It's come out from hundreds, thousands of sites in the United States and the rest of the world. And it's not really debatable among rational people anymore that these shots were completely unnecessary, that they were harmful, and that they were distributed with financial motive. And that evidence came out with the Pfizer dumps in the last few months in congressional hearings and the Twitter files, that the goal of this from the manufacturers was to develop a multi-billion dollar, every 3 months get another shot, endless train of money subsidized by the taxpayer. And the goal of the government, of course, was to keep people scared and stuck in hospitals and clinics constantly under the direction of doctors that were taking orders from the government rather than from their conscience. And I think that plan worked. I think it was very successful. This would never have been possible years ago. People would have said, wait, I'm going to wait. I don't think I need this. I'm young. I'm healthy. Nobody's dying of this in my age group. So it worked. It was successful. But it no longer works because even people who were supportive of it now realize that it really isn't healthy or helpful. None of these shots are needed. And for that reason, the government, the U.S. government, has actually started to step away from it. They've given up on this tool because it's no longer effective. You could say that that's good because it means we're moving forward towards truth, and the people that were compliant are now realizing that they were lied to, that the shots were not helpful and actually quite harmful in many cases. But I also think that it's more ominous because what it means is that this was a dress rehearsal for a totalitarian state. The end game was not just to get multiple shots in everyone's arms. That was a big incentive. And when the government told Pfizer and Moderna, we're going to give you hundreds of billions of dollars if you can trump up studies to show that this is needed and we'll subsidize this by forcing everyone to take it, everyone jumped up and said, great, we'd love to have that. We want to be rich. But that was just the short term. The long term, I believe, was to see, what are people willing to do? What are people willing to give up? What are people willing to accept with little evidence, only with fear, only with threat? And they realize that most Americans are willing to give up everything, even shoot up their children and allow their children to get sick and in some cases die of these shots when they were at zero risk of ever getting seriously ill or dying from the actual infection. And they won that. They learned that. That's their new baseline of what Americans are willing to do. So my fear is that what's going to happen next is going to be even worse. And I think that this is way beyond just a debate about compliance with medical policy. This is now an indication that to the government and to the media and the corporations that most Americans are going to be willing to give up anything at all as long as we scare them good enough and threaten them so that they don't feel that they have any other choice. So now the question is, what's next? It could be environmental. We're already seeing signs of energy being taken away from people, people being forced to give up their gas stoves, have to drive with electric cars, forced public transportation, not being able to perhaps take commercial flights unless you own your own Gulfstream, won't be able to travel. That could be next. There's all sorts of things that the government can start to do now because they've been given this green light. They've tested the water and they've said the temperature feels pretty good. We're just going to dive right in. So I think the next wave is coming. And that's why it's so important to me that we don't get distracted by arguments about the shots and the masks and the lockdowns. That was just a test. What's coming next could be even far worse. It could be an even worse terror and take away of our liberties. And the Americans who now are turning away from the shots, I mean, God bless them. I'm glad to hear that. But do they understand really why they're doing it? Is it just because they realize the shots are not that great? Or is it because they now realize that they were lied to and they can't trust the government for the next round? If they haven't reached the second stage, it's not going to matter because the next time the government comes knocking at their door, they're going to say, yeah, sure, shots didn't work, but I believe in the next one. I really worry that we haven't learned our lesson yet. That's my concern.
Yeah, that's interesting what you said, though. It feels to me, and it felt like the beginning stage or a test, I'll say that. It felt like a test for outright martial law. I don't know.
Yes, I agree with you.
You agree? Okay. That's what it felt like to me.
I completely agree. I completely agree.
The beginning stages of that had to be. I mean, you look back on it, it was 9/11. I mean, that scared the bejesus out of everybody. Everybody, you know, went along with the Patriot Act, and there it started a whole Pandora's box of intrusiveness and a lot of manipulation. And it just has never stopped from there. Has never stopped.
It was not clear to most people. It was clear to some, but it wasn't clear to most people that that was a seed. Because it seems so reasonable. We're under attack, terrorism, we could be bombed. We should be going after people. We should be breaking privacy rules. This is the sanctity of our nation. We have to cut some corners in order to protect ourselves. It was dangerous, but it seems sort of reasonable to a lot of people. But as you just pointed out, whether we can prove the motivation or not, the effect of that decision was to open up a door, a Pandora's box, as you said, which has never, we can never close it now. Now we have NSA surveillance of text messages, phone records. We're still taking off our shoes at the airport 20 years after the shoe bomber from San Rafael stuck a fuse in his Nike and tried to light it on a plane. We're being strip searched at the airports. We've got whole body scanners now sharing data with medical companies and insurance companies illegally violating privacy rights, all because we're trying to protect ourselves from another bomb, from another terrorist attack. Still going on. And that's just the beginning of it. It's still happening. And this is the end result of that. And this allowed what happened in the last 3 years to occur, because without the government having that kind of authority to then abuse, it could never have gotten away with this. But it had the tool sitting in the closet with just a little cord saying, pull this under emergency and go at it. You don't have to get a warrant or subpoena. Just use the tool if you need it. We trust you. Well, that violation of trust that we saw for 3 years should really scare us and should really give us grave pause and concern to what level and degree of power we've now allowed the government to use and manipulate. And I think we should be taking it back, actually.
Absolutely. We should take it back because it's, you can totally see how they planted the seed and they've ran with it. Basically, the fear was a big, huge part of that, too. I mean, there had to be a huge amount of fear in order for the mess. Huh? Say again.
It's the fuel.
It's the fuel that drove the car. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like a source of fuel. The fear fueled this abuse of power. Without the gasoline, the car wouldn't have been able to move forward. That's why fear is such an important part of this campaign. That's why I called my book Freedom from Fear, to get out of it. And why my original book was focused so much about the fear pandemic. I didn't call it a medical pandemic. I called it a fear pandemic. Because the medical threat was never really that important. We've killed and wrecked the lives of 10 times more people than the number that died from this virus. 96% of the people who died from the virus were incredibly sick with 3 or 4 comorbidities and over the age of like 74, 78 years old. They were going to die anyway. The average age lifespan in the U.S. is less than the actual lifespan of the people who died of the virus. So the virus didn't kill people. It didn't victimize the United States. It just took out some of the weak people that were already past their prime. Basically, that's what this disease did. And in order to pretend to protect them, which we didn't do, by the way, we failed to do that anyway, but just despite all of this loss of liberty, didn't even achieve its objective. Despite that, the price we paid for doing it was far greater than any potential reward we ever could have earned, ever. And we still haven't learned that lesson to a large extent. That's a huge problem, because the next time that wrecking ball, automobile, SUV, liberty-destroying vehicle wants to take out of the station, there's a nice fuel pump right next to it with 100 gallons of fuel of fear right there to be reloaded into the car. We've got to address this problem. We cannot allow our fear to control our decisions. We have to free ourselves from the addiction of fear. We have to address this fear problem. We have to acknowledge that being afraid does not mean you have to act a certain way. You can feel afraid and do something in spite of your fear. Courage, very rare today. Courage is not a character trait. Courage is not genetic. Courage is not something that you train for in the gym. Courage is nothing other than making a decision in the moment to feel whatever fear you have, to allow yourself to be scared, and to act in spite of it and take a risk. Taking a risk while afraid, that's all that courage is, and anyone can do that. Anybody. And I encourage everyone, every American, to act courageously every single day. If we could do that, we would quash the fear and we'd protect ourselves from the next disaster.
Very well said. I really enjoy this conversation with you, Mark.
Thank you.
The book is called Freedom from Fear, a 12-step guide to personal and national recovery. Please tell them where else they can keep up with you or anything else that you may be working on, Mark.
The only thing you need to remember is Dissident MD. I have a website called Dissident MD with links to my books, my Substack, which is also called Dissident MD, by the way, if you're already on Substack, my Twitter feed, my Facebook feed. Everything I write comes out of Dissident MD, because offering a differing view today makes you a dissident. If you want to listen and watch me talk and interview guests, the only other place that you might want to consider going to is our podcast, which is called Informed Dissent. You can get that on Apple Podcasts and Buzzsprout and all other podcasting feeds, or just go to the website and sign up for the newsletter, informeddissentmedia.com.
His other book is called The United States of Fear, How America Fell Victim to a Mass Delusional Psychosis. Dr. Mark McDonald, my special guest. Mark, many blessings to you, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, K-Town. That was fun.
To find out more about our guest and all others, please visit our website at mysteriousradio.com. And I want to give special thanks to our co-creator and executive producer, Kim Kyle, who brought this show to you today. And working hard behind the scenes, our team of four, I want to thank them as well. Follow us on social media and share the show with others that may like the subjects that we cover. I am your host, K-Town, and you're listening to Mysterious Radio.